on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Monday, November 26th. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5.05 p.m. and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from our UBC campus and from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Also on our show today is a special report prepared by News 101 correspondent D.P. Lale on the TransLink BC's HandyDart door-to-door transportation service that uses specially equipped vehicles for passengers with physical and cognitive disabilities. Also on today's show, we will be bringing you our weekly science segment, Simply Science, with Sarah Chow. This week is part two of Sarah's interview with Dr. Shaw and Dr. Tomlinovich about an HPV vaccine.
And all this plus your weekday weather forecast, brought to you by Environment Canada, right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your campus, local, and provincial headlines.
A well-established family of drugs used to treat parasitic diseases is showing surprising potential as a therapy for tuberculosis, according to new research from University of British Columbia microbiologists. The findings, published online this week in the journal Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy, are based on in vitro tests of the ivermectin family of drugs. Discovered nearly 40 years ago, the drugs are commonly used in the developing world to eliminate the parasitic worms that cause river blindness and elephantiasis, but have been thought to be ineffective against bacterial diseases. The UBC study shows that in the lab, the drugs actually killed the bacteria that caused TB, including drug-resistant forms. UBC researcher Santiago Ramon Garcia, a co-author on the paper, says, quote, "These drugs are cheap, routinely produced by pharmaceutical companies, and in many cases approved for human uses. So the jump from lab bench to clinic could be much quicker," end quote. The international collaboration was led by scientists in UBC's Department of Microbiology and Immunology associated with UBC's Center for Tuberculosis Research and the Neglected Global Diseases Initiative. Further studies are needed to assess the drug's clinical application for treating TB. UBC researchers are now working with animal models to determine effective dosage levels and regimens. They will also study whether ivermectins could be combined with other drugs to create effective therapies.
According to a lawsuit launched against the City of Vancouver last Thursday, people without homes should be allowed to legally sleep on Vancouver's streets. The lawsuit launched by the Pivot Legal Society will attempt to reverse three bylaws that prevent those without shelter from sleeping or erecting structures on streets, parks, and other city property. The society believes that these rules violate the constitutional right to life, liberty, and security. Lawyer Scott Bernstein said that the Pivot Legal Society filed the lawsuit because the city has refused to amend its bylaws that directly affect about 1,605 people in the city of Vancouver and about 2,663 in Metro Vancouver that are currently homeless. Comparable Victoria bylaws were changed in a similar lawsuit in 2008. Mayor Gregor Robertson said in a statement in response to this lawsuit that the city wants to, quote, "strike a balance between helping and protecting our most vulnerable citizens while ensuring all members of the public can fairly use and access our public spaces." Mayor went on to say, quote, being homeless is not a crime. The city is committed to ensuring that our bylaws are enforced appropriately and are not punishing those who are homeless.
The University of British Columbia and Simon Fraser University will lead an international coalition to help developing countries benefit from their natural resources in environmentally and socially responsible ways. The establishment of the Canadian International Institute for Extractive Industries and Development, or CIIEID, funded by a $25 million grant from the Canadian International Development Agency, was announced last October with an aim to sharing Canadian expertise in extractive industries. The selection of UBC and SFU to operate the institute was announced on Friday by Julian Fantino, Minister of International Cooperation. CIIEID will offer developing countries best practice knowledge in extractive technology, public policy and regulations, and health and education outreach in order to empower industry, governments, and non-governmental organizations to reduce poverty while protecting the environment. Among the first tasks of CIIEID include a strategic analysis of the sector, delivering of educational courses in Canada and overseas, and two conferences. The initial activities will focus on countries in Latin America, Sub-Saharan Africa, and Asia.
Vancouver City Councillor George F. Fleck recently announced that in an effort to have a clear and transparent process for anonymous donations, he will propose a motion in council next week that staff enhance and add to Vancouver's current giving programs. Two large donations currently under scrutiny are a $30 million gift for healthcare facility Taylor Manor and a reported $10 million to extend the seawall from Kitts Beach to Jericho Beach. While some councillors and the mayor are in on the secret, according to the motion, others are kept in the dark regarding millions of dollars that will shape the city. If the motion passes, council will get the details on current proposed donations, along with a tally of all anonymous donations received over the past 10 years, and staff will recommend how to improve the existing donation structure.
And now for your national news. The BC mining company that has prompted legal actions and a federal government policy review over the hiring of Chinese miners says it is working with a college in northern BC to develop training for Canadian workers. The agreement between HD Mining International Limited and Northern Lights College calls for the development of a curriculum for training people in the longwall underground mining technique to be used at Murray River Mine near Tumbler Ridge, said company vice president Jody Shimkus. Shimkus said the mine will employ about 600 people when it reaches full capacity in the fall of 2015, and the company has a 10-year plan to transfer to a Canadian workforce. Several unions have asked the federal court to conduct a judicial review of the temporary work permits, claiming the miners have been brought in from China for lower wages. They want an injunction to stop the company from bringing in 60 workers scheduled to arrive in mid-December until the case is resolved. The company was reported to have also planned eventually to bring in another 140 workers from China. Shimkus said HD Mining has federal government approval to bring in miners for exploratory work at the mine, and those plans stand. However, the controversy has led the federal government to announce a review of its entire temporary foreign worker program. Northern Lights College has six campuses in northern BC, including one in Tumbler Ridge.
Britain named Canadian Central Bank Chief Mark Carney on Monday to head the Bank of England, springing the surprise choice of a foreigner to push reform of its troubled financial system. A former Goldman Sachs investment banker, who at the Bank of Canada guided the Canadian economy through the global economic crisis, Mark Carney will succeed Mervyn King, who retires in July of next year. Carney, who already plays a leading role in setting global banking rules, defended his departure from Canada and signaled that bigger problems awaited him in London. In a news conference, Carney said, quote, I'm going to where the challenges are greatest. It's very important for the global economy that the UK does well, that it succeeds in this rebalancing of their economy, that the reform of the British financial system is completed. End quote. Carney will become the first non-British head of the central bank in its 300-year history, beating Bank of England Deputy Governor Paul Tucker to the post. During the crisis, Carney helped to make Canada's recession one of the shallowest of the world's richest nations, No Canadian bank needed government help, and the country recovered all the jobs it lost in the downturn relatively rapidly.
And those were your UBC campus, local, and provincial and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for a special report prepared by News 101 correspondent DP Lille on the TransLink BC's HandyDart service.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Commercial Drive area at
Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
Listen up, fellow students, readers, and patrons of the UBC Bookstore. This upcoming November 27th, our beloved bookstore is hosting their very own Res Night for all UBC students. They'll be treating you to a night of free snacks to keep that brain fed, gaming, music courtesy of DJ Ochre, and need I mention, crazy discounts on books and supplies. Watch me be there stacking up on pencil cases. We're kicking the night off at 5 p.m., and for more info, check out the website at bookstore.ubc.ca.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
It is now time for our special story prepared by News 101 correspondent DP Lille, who's been working for the last little while on the story on the HandyDart service.
I'm DP Lille reporting for News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. Today, I will be bringing you a story about the HandyDart transportation service. HandyDart is a transportation bus that is owned by TransLink, so that disabled persons and seniors can travel on their own whenever they would like. However, in the last 4 years, HandyDart standards have slipped and the current level of service is inadequate. There are fewer buses on the road to serve the people's needs, and as the population ages, this is only going to get worse. The HandyDart service is extremely important for maintaining users' physical and mental well-being, because they often cannot use other types of transportation. Without HandyDart, they lose their independence and freedom. I had the pleasure to speak to three individuals who have some knowledge about HandyDart transportation. First, I had a chance to speak with Linda McGowan, who is the Consumer Advocacy Manager for MVT Canadian Bus. Here, Ms. McGowan gives us background information on what she does and what HandyDart is. Hello, Ms. McGowan. Thank you for meeting with me today. Is MVT a part of TransLink or is it a different division?
MVT Canadian Bus Incorporated is a private Canadian company that has been contracted by TransLink to provide HandyDart services. TransLink owns HandyDart.
What does MVT stand for?
It's called Medical Van Transportation.
How long have you been with MVT Canadian Bus Corporation?
I became an employee in November 2008.
So 4 years. Can you tell us a bit about your role with MVT Canadian Bus Corporation?
My role is I'm the consumer advocate. The Vancouver system is very large. And what I do is I work with individuals and families anywhere where there's people with disabilities needing HandyDart transportation. I'm available 7 days a week, 7 evenings a week when I'm in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. The only exception is that when the Stanley Cup playoffs are on, you have to phone between periods.
What changes has the company made on its operations and services recently?
One of the main things is prior to that time, there were 8 different providers who did things 8 different ways. Mm-hmm. Now, They tried to make the system consistent between all municipalities. And prior to MVT coming to Vancouver, many of the municipalities did not provide service outside their own municipality. For anything other than a direct medical appointment, the service stopped at Boundary Road.
Can you tell us about the changes that have occurred from changing from a non-profit to a for-profit organization?
Unfortunately, Vancouver is growing. There are more people requesting handy dart type service, and there's less service available. We currently have 50 fewer buses than we had 3.5 years ago. The service hours that were provided last year have not increased for this year. So Handy Dart provides somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 trips every day. It's a first-come, first-served basis. And when the buses are fully scheduled, they're fully scheduled.
Why are there less buses on the road than compared to a couple of years ago?
I think it's the cost thing, is that as the buses retire, they bought new buses, but the new buses cost more, and they don't buy as many as they take off the road.
How do you think these changes have impacted Handy Dart users?
The changes related to the growth is that there is less service hours available, and people are getting denied more often. At the beginning, when MVT came, you could call 1 to 7 days in advance, and you can still do that. But if you wait to call 2 days in advance, your chances of getting what you want are getting pretty slim.
Do you think Handy Dart users have suffered because of these changes?
Well, they've certainly had improvement. The fact that Handy Dart will go cross-boundary is an improvement. The reminder phone calls are an improvement. What's difficult is the reduction in hours and reduction in service hours and the reduction in buses and the increase in population. You combine all of those, I think it puts more pressure on people with disabilities getting the kind of transportation they want and need.
Why have there been cutbacks in buses?
I think it's a financial thing. Yeah. Buses cost a lot of money. There's pressure in the community to use the money and spread it around everywhere.
What kinds of complaints are you getting from your customers regarding Handy Dart service?
I get that Handy Dart is late, that it took me a long time to get where I'm going. We get some complaints about staffing. Generally, our drivers are worth their weight in gold, but I always say there's one bad apple in every barrel. And we get complaints that I need this trip, and they can't do it for me.
Are your revenues based on fixed grants, or is it made through a fee per rider?
MVT is provided a certain number of money every year, and they must provide a certain number of service hours within that budget.
Okay.
So if the buses need more maintenance or too many people are sick, that all comes out of, the MVT has to accommodate that within the budget.
So for someone who's paying for a ticket or a bus pass, where does that money go?
That money goes to TransLink.
Okay. Where do you see the Handy Dart system 10 years from now?
I think if it's very busy now, it's going to be much busier in 10 years from now. I think in that time it will have to expand. I think that the eligibility to use Handy Dart may tighten up. I think you may be looking at smaller buses.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Linda, for meeting with me and allowing me to interview you.
Thank you.
The second individual I spoke to is Jody, a Handy Dart client that has had long-term experiences with the system and has seen many changes throughout the years. Hi, Jody. Thank you for meeting with us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing good.
Okay, my first question is, how long have you been taking the Handy Dart buses?
Quite a while, a long, long time.
Can you tell me about your experiences with Handy Dart?
I've had so many issues, like going to Vancouver and getting around in Richmond. And I've also called Handy Darts and booking and arranging Handy Darts and stuff and changing the time. Are you happy with the service and why and why not? I'm not happy because sometimes it's tough for me. I have to wait for an hour and a half for my ride. Are you able to get to all the places that you want to go? For example, in Vancouver or in Burnaby? No, I don't, because that's the part I'm having difficulty with. With Burnaby, I have to be transferred and I can't travel by myself. I have to have someone with me. Can you tell me more about your recent experiences with the Handy Dart and how the service has changed throughout the years? Well, before it was so easy because I could get Handy Dart everywhere, but now that they changed the service, I think it's more difficulty. It's hard for me to press one like other numbers, and I think it should be, instead of saying press one, just say the number one.
So better access with the phone. And
yeah.
Okay. Has the service affected your ability to get around?
Yes, it has.
Can you give me an example of how it has affected you to get around, what step you need to do?
Well,
to
I have there. To call 8 to 7 days in advance, and I have to call ahead to book wherever I want to go. And it's kind of tough. One time I took Maple Ridge, and I had to be transferred 3 Handy Darts. That took me a while, and I had to be there by 1. For return, I had to take 2 Handy Darts. So it's a long day for me. So I think they should have like a better service and more access.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jody, for allowing me to talk to you.
No problem.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
The last person I spoke to is Beth, a support worker who has had a lot of experience working with clients that use the Handy Dart system. She also has a family member who takes this transportation service. Here she is giving her perspective on the system. Hi, Beth. Thank you for meeting with me today. My first question is, what are your thoughts on the current level of service at Handy Dart?
The drivers are great people, and they're trying to do a really tough job. It's the company that's not supportive of the client's needs. They do not put sufficient drivers on to handle the volume of the clients or the distance involved in the request by the clients. The drivers are often frustrated, and they have to backtrack a lot in order to give the service that the client is asking for.
Have you seen a lot of changes in the level of service in the last few years with the Handy Dart?
Several changes. It used to run a lot smoother. The booking system is not set up for convenience to the client anymore. The need to call in a week in advance is difficult on a lot of occasions. And if you need a ride to a medical appointment and you cannot get short notice bookings made, it's becoming more frustrating for the clients to try and book rides.
Mm-hmm. How do you think Handy Dart, or the service itself, can improve?
They need to improve on the evening services that they provide. There's many wheelchairs and people with walking disabilities that don't have any way to attend social functions, late jobs, schooling. For instance, when co-workers want to go to a Christmas party, people can get there, but there's no way home. There's no buses close to their place. There's no other way for people to get back, so they cannot attend functions like other adults, and they cannot socialize with their peers. That is a service that really needs to be looked at, because these are adults that need to be respected as adults. Just because you have a need doesn't mean that you should be treated so much differently in our society.
And you said there's no other buses. Are you saying TransLink buses and SkyTrains? Can anybody use those?
They can use them, but I don't know of a lot of people that have a bus stop directly in front of their home. Most people with disabilities do not have that privilege. And so to be able to access the SkyTrain and board a bus and then get off of the bus nearest to their home, it's an issue. And if it's an evening, especially a winter evening where it's probably rainy, the roads are shiny, cars don't even slow down for bicycles, never mind somebody with a slower mobility issue. So I think if the people running Handy Dart actually had to walk with somebody late night, I think they would find out that the cold rain after a Christmas party isn't where they want to be either.
How do you think the level of service has affected the people that you work with?
When it runs according to their objective, it's a major influence on maintaining someone's independence. With such poor management that's been happening lately, it's very frustrating. And the priorizing that Handy Dart is doing, it just leaves people in the lurch. The clients are not able to attend their group or the program activities. They're experiencing a lot of independence issues because when they cannot get a ride to or from, then quite often they just have to cancel and not participate with groups or with jobs. Because of the poor management of Handy Dart, people are losing their independence. And in this society, in this day and age, that is really disgraceful.
From your personal standpoint, how do you think the services have affected your mother and her mobility?
Initially, she's really thrilled that she's able to have a Handy Dart service and be able to get to and from the programs that she wants to do in the daytime. However, dementia is an issue, and there's no way for a checkpoint system for regular riders. And when dementia is an issue, there again, this system is failing them because there is no way for them to get a ride. And if most of the seniors cannot afford the taxis, a lot of seniors cannot just ride the bus. If they could, they wouldn't be using the Handy Dart. And so there again, Handy Dart really needs to look at this booking system that they have and the way that they need to be able to book in a shorter period of time and have a better scheduling process so that when people do have a short notice request, even if it is fitting in a doctor's appointment suddenly because they've come down with the flu, they need to be able to get Handy Dart, they need to be able to get a ride, they need to be able to maintain a sense of independence just for their own personal well-being and state of mind.
For the place that she needs to be, mm-hmm. sometimes she forgets to call and book an appointment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How does she get there then? Does she go at all?
On a good day, when her dementia is not affecting her and where she's able to think things through, she can actually board a bus and get off at the right stop. Other days, she is so frustrated that she just retracts and stays in the house because she's so confused and upset.
Thank you very much, Beth, for taking the time to chatting with me.
You are welcome. This was a pleasure to be part of. Thank you.
Thank you. As you heard from Linda, Jody, and Beth, although there are some parts of the Handy Dart service that do work well, overall, current operations are decreasing, and this is hurting passengers' well-being. If this service doesn't improve, people with disabilities will continue to see a decrease in their ability to travel, and this will affect their freedom and independence, holding them back from doing what matters in life. These activities are not only recreational, but they are also vital for individuals' mental and physical health. Families and caregivers will also be affected because they will be held back when an individual with disability is unable to travel. So I ask you, CITR listeners, do you think this is right?
If not, please let Handy Dart know your concerns by calling Handy Dart at 604-575-6600, extension 5. Everyone can make a difference, and your voice counts. For News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, I'm DP Lale.
Thanks to DP for that story. Keep on listening to CITR News 101 in the future for more stories by DP. We are going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with your weather forecast and Simply Science by Sarah Chow.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. You just heard a segment, a special report by our correspondent DP Lale, and you can listen to it once again on our website citr.ca/news and on our Mixcloud account. It is now time for your weekday weather forecast, and for that we go to Environment Canada. Tonight, a few clouds with a low of plus one. It's just above the 0 degrees, so you might want to stay inside. Tuesday, a mix of sun and clouds with a high of 6 degrees. Tuesday night, partly cloudy, becoming cloudy towards the evening and night with a low of plus four. Wednesday, we shall have periods of rain with a high of 10 and a low of plus four. Thursday, it will be cloudy and rainy with a low of 8 and a high of 11. And Friday, we will have rain once again with a low of 8 and a high of 10. So that was your weekday weather forecast brought to you by Environment Canada. We now go to our science segment, Simply Science by Sarah Chow. This is part 2 of her interview with Dr. Tom Lejovic and Dr. Shaw about the development of an HPV vaccine.
This is Simply Science, bringing you your science news. I'm Sarah Chow. In the last edition of Simply Science, we heard about the research Dr. Shaw and Dr. Tom Lejovic were doing on Merck's HPV vaccine, Gardasil. What they found was that Gardasil, which claims to protect against 75% of cervical and vaginal cancer cases in young women and 90% of genital wart cases in young men, may not be as safe as we think. Here's a continuation of the interview.
Gardasil only came into market in 2006, right? Mm-hmm. It hasn't, I mean, smoking has been forever, and we know now that it does, in fact, cause cancer. So how does Merck know that this vaccine protects 75% of...
They don't.
Right, so how did they get to that conclusion, though?
Well, how they got to this conclusion is they basically showed that the vaccine is effective in clearing precancerous lesions, the SYN2 and 3 precancerous lesions, and that it's also very effective in clearing HPV 16 and 18 infection. Mm-hmm. However, 90% of HPV 16 and 18 infection clear on their own. And a lot of the precancerous lesions, even the high grade, the highest grade, the SYN3 lesions, will clear up in 40% cases. So given enough time, these lesions would have cleared up regardless of the vaccine status. And when the vaccine was approved, they've only studied the effects for 3 years. Actual cancer takes 20 years to develop.
So nobody in that cohort has aged to that level. So they don't know. They don't know if it's presented a single case of cancer. It may do. We may, in 10 years, we may know. And but right now, they can't make that statement. They don't know.
They make this assumption that because it prevents precancerous lesions, that equates to proportion of cancers.
Right, and that's not true.
But they haven't considered many factors, and the fact that many women are actually infected with numerous strains, not just HPV 16 and 18, but other strains. Yes, it's true that the HPV 16 and 18 make up for up to 70% of all cancers, so they are the ones that are predominantly found in cancers. Mm-hmm. But you can get multiple infections. And because they haven't studied the vaccine long enough, they really don't know if it can truly prevent cancer or simply postpone it. The other problem is that you have pap screening, which has demonstrably reduced the incidence of mortality from cervical cancer, 75% in developed countries. So bottom line is that even if the vaccines were proven to be as effective as claimed, it's unlikely that they would reduce cervical cancer any more than was already achieved with pap screening. Mm-hmm. Pap screening, as opposed to the vaccinations, does not carry the risk for autoimmune reactions.
We talk about what's called the greater good argument. We're going to save so many people, and a few people are going to have. Okay, and that, as long as that ratio stays like that, that's okay. Mm-hmm. We're going to accept that. Mm-hmm. But when the ratio changes, when you can't actually demonstrate that you've saved anybody yet, and you very clearly, unless you're going to ignore the VAERS data and the other databases that show adverse reactions, that ratio has now shifted. And HPV vaccine is one of the ones where it shifted very, very badly.
The problem is, again, that in the peer review papers, Merck did not report all the results from their clinical trials. They kind of cherry-picked and just put the best results. And they also actually found that in women with prior exposure to HPV 16 and 18, that the vaccine actually had negative efficacy. Mm-hmm. And Merck actually expressed that there were concerns. Problem is that this vaccine is prescribed to everyone, and they do not bother to do the test to see if the woman has prior exposure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So unless you married your elementary school sweetheart, and never had sex with anybody else, and they didn't either, and now you're 45, then you probably never were exposed. But otherwise, most of us have been. You know, and so that this is very hazardous to be doing this without people being aware that even Merck's own study showing the negative efficacy.
The most disturbing fact is that you see that the vaccine and manufacturers is more cautious.
It's true.
Because they say, okay, this is the concern. Then they submit this to the FDA, and FDA chooses somehow to ignore these concerns.
I know, it's remarkable. It struck us several times over the last year, basically, that Merck they are actually in their product sheets more careful in what they say than the regulatory agencies. The regulatory agencies cherry-pick the good parts and make this a vaccine that even Merck doesn't claim it is. You know, why are you making the company's own literature sound better than the company made it in the first place? It doesn't make sense to me.
You get the statements from the US CDC and FDA that they literally say this is a life-saving vaccine.
Anti-cancer vaccine.
And
Merck makes no such claim.
The US CDC and FDA recommend this vaccine for prevention of all cervical cancers. How can you make that claim if the vaccine so far has not prevented a single case? Mm-hmm. You cannot make this strong claim because you're really misleading the public.
People want to do whatever they want with their bodies, that's fine, but they have to know what the risks and benefits are. And so when people talk to their healthcare providers, and the healthcare provider may only have part of the story and not be aware that there can be serious concerns, they're not providing that basis for informed consent.
So what are you guys doing to help get the word out that maybe Gardasil isn't as good as Merck says?
Well, talking to you is one. But mostly, you know, we're scientists. We'll just do more science and do a better study that will have more individual samples and have controls and put it into a good mainstream peer-reviewed journal and hope that other people will also start looking at the issue and see if there's something that we need to worry about.
And we publish numerous papers, reviews outlining all these hiccups in data reporting and data interpretation.
But it's the regulatory agencies, in my view, that are failing to do their due diligence and to do their fiduciary responsibility to the public to provide that informed basis so that people can make informed choices.
Do you feel like you're fighting against something in a way? Like you just said, you know, this view is already true. Why are you even...
There is a certain pushback doing this sort of research. So I think there is a concern that somehow we are calling into question vaccination in general.
which we're not. So that that's some
clear. You're not saying all vaccines is horrible. It's just
not at all.
This particular
not at all. But I mean, you know, one of the ad hominem things that we hear floated is that all those anti-vaxxers. Well, we're not. You know, we look at these things on a case by case basis. We are simply raising a concern, as other people have done in various other forums and other scientific journals. You know, the analogy we use sometimes, you know, if we say that certain airplane components are not safe, because airplanes do crash occasionally, we're not calling into question airplanes in general. We're not calling into question whether it's a good way to get from point A to point B. We're not trying to crash the North American economy. We're just saying that in some circumstances, airplane manufacturer of a certain type that crashes needs to be made safer and better. And I don't think anyone would disagree with that. Somehow, when you get into that topic of vaccination or any vaccine, it's as if you walked into this holy ground that you dare not say anything in that holy ground about the whole subject. And any part of that subject is now forbidden territory. And so there's been a little bit of that attitude that's kind of come back in us.
So just to be clear, you guys are not anti-vaccine.
I don't like the use of that term.
It's about,
yeah.
For me, it's like, you know, investigate the evidence.
Yeah,
investigate the quality of the study for each individual vaccine.
Exactly. As you would for any individual medicine of any kind.
Nothing, again, in science should be beyond question or settled with 100% because science is limited. As a scientist, you're supposed to critically evaluate the evidence.
So I'm a neuroscientist.
And then make up your mind.
So it's a very contentious area that gets tempers up really, really high very quickly. And there seems to be no middle ground. There seems to be kind of your default, you know, I'm on this side, and if you're on the other side, you've got to be either in the pay of the pharma or an anti-vaxxer. You can't be anything else. And I think there are a lot of scientists like us who are simply saying, well, you know, let's ask the questions. Nothing's black and white. Everything's kind of gray. Let's see how these things can be, you know, if there's a safety issue, how they can be made safer. If there's an efficacy issue, how they can be made more effective.
So last question to sum this all up. So we talked about public needs to know both sides.
Yep.
They need to know what's good and what's bad in vaccines. So if someone's not like scientifically inclined, where should they go?
I would not simply not just rely on what the FDA or the CDC says or Health Canada. I would look at other sources of information. And again, this is not conspiracy websites or some dodgy website.
Right,
a lot of them have been put up by medical professionals.
That's right.
And by scientists who have basically simply compiled the evidence, said, here it is, look at it.
The web has great stuff and has trash. And so it does require people to be more involved consumers and more involved in terms of doing their own research so that they can interact with their health provider more effectively. Because their health provider may not know the literature. Or may not know the most current literature and or the controversies
because
in the field.
Because they simply don't have that time.
They don't have the time. You know, they're the Z people. And so maybe if people go in with some of the papers that are out there that are published in mainstream peer-reviewed journals and ask their health provider, then they're going to get a better balance discussion about the risks and benefits of any procedure. And that applies to heart stents as well as it applies to, you know, having your toenail fungus dealt with.
And for me, like, I know we live busy lifestyles, but this is something important. It's the health of your children. So I think it's worth putting time.
Thank you, Dr. Shaw and Dr. Tom Lenjevec, for taking the time to talk to Simply Science about your research. Well, that's it for this week for Simply Science. For CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, I'm Sarah Chow.
And thank you to Sarah Chow for that Simply Science segment. You can, of course, listen to it once again on our website, citr.ca/news. We are going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your international headlines.
Song called Broken Hearted Beat.
AMS Events proudly presents Tim Chasen with Poor Young Things, November 29th at the Pit Pub. With his newest album, The Other Side, the pride of PEI is quite literally going back to his roots. The album takes on a tinge of maritime roots and folk, incorporating an array of acoustic instruments and a warm, transparent production style. Since 2009's Broken Hearted Beat, audiences were introduced to a golden voice young performer slash songwriter with a mosaic-like approach to writing music named Tim Chasen, and he's an act you don't want to miss. Thursday, November 29th at the Pit Pub. Sponsored by CITR 101.9 FM.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. It's now time for your international headlines with Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in headlines. Across Egypt, protests are growing and clashes continue following President Mohamed Morsi's declaration last week granting himself sweeping immunity and absolute power. According to Egypt's health ministry today, two people died in the ensuing unrest, one of them a 15-year-old boy. More than 400 others were injured. After a contentious meeting yesterday, members of the Egyptian Journalist Syndicate threatened a general strike, with one board member calling the decree naked aggression against general freedoms, the rule of law, and the independence of the judiciary. President Morsi said the decree will be in effect until a new parliament is elected, which can't happen until a new constitution is drafted. Tahrir Square is rapidly filling up ahead of protests tomorrow. A group of alleged internet hackers went on trial today in Turkey on charges of terrorism. It's the first time Turkey has used its broad anti-terror laws to prosecute computer hackers, with each of the accused facing lengthy prison sentences if convicted. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports.
10 defendants appeared in court in the capital Ankara today. According to state media, they're accused of belonging to Red Hack, a left-wing hackers group that's vandalized Turkish government websites as well as the national airline. Three of the defendants have been in pretrial detention since they were arrested in March. All reject the charges, insisting they merely shared news about hacking on social media websites. They deny any ties to Red Hack, a group that claims links to the international hackers collective Anonymous. Turkey has strengthened its anti-terror laws to include cybercrime, but human rights groups say Turkey is using these laws to prosecute people for political activities. Prosecutors have invoked anti-terror laws, accusing the hackers of ties to armed groups. If convicted, the individuals, some of whom are still in high school, face prison sentences ranging from 8 to 25 years. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
A group of farmers in central India is protesting the government's taking of their land for a proposed thermal power plant, threatening to set themselves on fire. Shurya Niazi reports.
About 24 farmers in the Katni district of the state sit on funeral pyres every day, threatening to burn themselves alive if the state government does not return their land. Earlier this month, one woman already committed suicide by self-immolation after she was forced to give away her land for the 2,000 megawatt project. The villagers refused to give up their fertile and irrigated farmland for industry. The government provided 800 acres and says that the farmers had earlier agreed to the plan. The opposition Congress says land grabs are happening across the region and has called for statewide protests on December 2nd. Shurya Niazi, FSRN, Bhopal.
A Texas high school student is back in class today after being suspended for refusing to wear an ID embedded with a radio frequency identification chip that would track her movements around campus. Andrew Oxford reports from San Antonio.
Officials at Northside Independent School District in San Antonio, Texas, say all of their more than 90,000 students may someday be required to wear ID cards embedded with an RFID chip. School administrators say the Student Locator Project is designed to track students around campus and provide a more accurate attendance record. Students at two schools are already required to carry the cards, and families and community members are concerned about privacy and civil liberties. Andrea Hernandez, a sophomore at John Jay High School, was suspended last week when she refused to wear her new ID card. A county judge then granted Hernandez a temporary restraining order to stop her suspension. Rutherford Institute attorney James Whitehead represents Hernandez and sees a bigger issue at play.
The overarching issue, as I see here, and the Hernandez see this, is basically teaching kids to learn to live in a surveillance state.
A hearing is scheduled for Wednesday. Andrew Oxford, FSRN, San Antonio.
Rebel fighters in Syria seized a hydroelectric dam on the Euphrates River, the latest in a series of rebel advances. Government airplanes, however, targeted a Free Syrian Army outpost in the border village of Atima today. Turkey dispatched a fighter jet in reply. Jackson Allers brings us up to date from neighboring Lebanon.
The Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad continues to lose control of large areas of northern Syria to opposition rebels and to formerly pro-government Kurdish militias. Today, the Syrian Air Force struck back against rebel-held positions in the north, targeting but missing an opposition rebel unit reportedly hiding in a school in the border town of Atima. Several people were wounded in the attack, And 80 miles to the east, Syrian rebels seized control of the Tishrin Dam near the town of Menji in the pre-dawn hours today. The hydroelectric dam supplies many northern areas of Syria with electricity. The loss was a major blow to the regime, embroiled in a civil war since March 2011. Syrian human rights groups estimate 40,000 people have been killed and hundreds of thousands more forced to flee to neighboring Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, and Turkey. Jackson Ellers, FSRN, Beirut, Lebanon.
We'll have more coverage on Syria later in the newscast. Stay tuned. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Palestinian and Israeli officials continue negotiations following last week's ceasefire to end the attacks on Gaza and rocket fire into Israel. Egyptian mediators are facilitating indirect talks in Cairo on the terms of the ceasefire. Palestinians hope the negotiations will lead to an opening of border crossings and an easing of the blockade. Starting Saturday, fishermen in Gaza were able to venture beyond the 3-mile limit after Israel lifted the ban it had been enforcing for 3 years. Although there is optimism, the latest cycle of violence had a heavy impact on Gaza. Over the weekend, the UN Special Envoy to the Middle East visited Gaza to assess the damage and called on both sides to respect the ceasefire. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more from Gaza.
Israel's 8-day-long attack on Gaza killed an estimated 130 to 170 Palestinians, according to UN and Hamas figures. More than 1,000 were injured and many homes, buildings destroyed. Rocket fire into Israel killed 6 and injured 8 critically. More than 200 were lightly injured, according to Israeli officials. UN envoy to the Middle East, Robert Seri, traveled to Gaza Sunday to inspect the damage and urge Israelis and Palestinians to respect the ceasefire, Seri addressed reporters at a press conference.
It is unacceptable for civilians on both sides, here but also in Israel, to live in fear of the next strike. All parties must ensure the protection of civilians at all times.
24 hours after the agreement, Israeli forces shot and killed an unarmed young man and wounded more than 20 others in southeastern Gaza-Israel border. Seri said that attack should be addressed and the United Nations is willing to help both sides solidify the ceasefire.
What makes me a bit more hopeful in terms of previous occasions when we're restoring a ceasefire is that we now have a mechanism to at least discuss all the underlying issues. I've been telling you that if we want to restore calm and stability here in Gaza, we have to look at all the elements of Resolution 1860.
The UN Security Council passed Resolution 1860 in January 2009, calling for a ceasefire during Israel's last war, Operation Cast Lead. Neither side implemented the terms of that agreement. According to an initial UN-led assessment of the damages from the violence that ended last week, Israeli air strikes on Gaza left 700 families homeless and damaged or destroyed hundreds of civilian buildings, including a sports facility, government offices, mosques, and a coastal bridge. Rami Almighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
U.S. retailers have pushed consumers to shop online today in what's become known as Cyber Monday, but labor rights advocates are calling on people to boycott the event, saying workers processing the orders are often subject to dangerous sweatshop-like working conditions. The call for a boycott follows nationwide protests at Walmart stores on Black Friday. Protesters gathered at a Walmart supercenter in Lakewood, a suburb of Denver. FSRN's Jim Pullen asked why they came out to support Walmart workers.
You know, I just want to help out the people of Walmart. Everybody knows that they just don't make enough money, and everyone knows that the Waltons, the Walton family has an exorbitant amount of money, and it's just not fair how they treat their employees. And I just want to come out here and just let, I guess, the people of Walmart know that as a consumer, as a concerned citizen, you know, I believe their workers deserve better, and I'm not going to shop here anymore until, you know, they increase workers' wages and workers' benefits.
There is a strike going on, but whether or not these people are going to be brave enough to risk their jobs to join us, I don't know. And I don't know how many of these people who are with us are Walmart associates, but they're definitely risking their jobs. They'll fire people for speaking out, much less picketing. They've tried to stop the whole thing with an injunction, claiming that our whole purpose here was to get Walmart to recognize a specific union. But actually, we're here fighting for little things like living wages, health insurance benefits. They've purposely cut people's hours so that they can avoid paying them health care.
It's not like we personally have something against Walmart, but it's what how Walmart treats the workers. In this country, even the politicians stand up and say, you need more jobs. My influence of the fact is this country does need new jobs. They don't need to ship them overseas, but they should be livable paying wages.
According to United Food and Commercial Workers, an estimated 1,000 protests took place across the country. It's not clear how many Walmart workers walked off the job, but the group organization United for Respect at Walmart said hundreds did not report to work, according to the New York Times. Walmart said participation was negligible compared to the number of employees it has on the workforce and that the walkouts did not affect Black Friday sales. Both Walmart and labor groups have filed complaints against each other with the National Labor Relations Board.
Thank you to FSRN for those international headlines. For more international news and their full newscast, you can look at their website, fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that is our program for today, Monday, November 26, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, please join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. Today's show was produced by CJ. From the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands right here on CITR 101.9 FM.